There's so much to take hold of in the readings today, to invite our prayers and reflection. From the great prophet Amos, preaching in the 8th century BCE, there is the image of the plumb line, showing that just as surely as a builder uses a plumb line to find the vertical and build a strong wall, so also the word and presence of God among us keeps us oriented and upright. A powerful insight that names our experience, I think, that God is among us in a way that is as clear and as strong and consistent and experiential as the pull of gravity. In so many ways, Amos's voice is a powerful one for today, even after 3,000 years almost, in his unrelenting call for both social justice and spirituality. Alongside that is the story of another great prophetic voice from the New Testament, that of John the Baptizer, who, like Amos, called the powerful to account fearlessly. This horrifying account of how Herod is tricked by his wife and stepdaughter into having John beheaded, and then serving up his head on a platter at a public banquet, drips with scandal, pain, sorrow, and a sickening level of family dysfunction. The tale has been the basis of numerous works by great artists and lesser-known artists as well, writers and composers from Filippo Lippi, Titian, and Caravaggio, to Flaubert, Oscar Wilde, and Richard Strauss, whose operatic setting of Wilde's play entitled Salome is still in heavy rotation on the operatic stage. But another aspect of this sordid tale is more likely worth our attention and reflection. It's the first three verses of today's gospel passage that I want to focus on. These tell of King Herod's reaction to the mission of Jesus and the disciples that I preached about last week. Apparently, after they were thrown out of Jesus' hometown at Nazareth, their mission to the surrounding towns was so successful that the name of Jesus became known. It's a telling word. This mission of the disciples, in which they took nothing with them, was so successful that Jesus became known. So much so that the king hears of him. After what we read about Herod this morning, I'm not sure I would really want to become known by Herod. It's clear to me that Jesus understands the full import of being known by Herod as well. And especially because of what is being said about Jesus by Herod and others. They don't just say, "Wow, that Jesus is really making a splash, eh? Wow, Jesus has got a lot of followers." They say, "Jesus is the resurrection of John." That's powerful. The Jesus is the resurrection of John. He's not just himself. His success, his inspiring message, his healing work, his gospel are not seen as his own. They believe he is John the Baptist, raised from the dead, the greatest prophet and teacher they have thus far known, raised from the dead. In my reading of Mark, the impact of this on Jesus is palpable. His beloved friend, his teacher, the one whom Jesus himself is a follower, the person who baptized him, is murdered for a party trick of unspeakable cruelty. It has a huge impact on Jesus. And Jesus' reaction is almost visceral. He needs to get away. The disciples return from their mission trips, all bubbling over with the great things they've done. But Jesus can barely stomach it. He takes them away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves, unquote. But they find no peace. Thousands of John's followers from all the towns come after him. When he comes ashore, when Jesus comes ashore from the boat in this deserted place, thinking he's come to a deserted place with his closest friends to rest and recover from the horrifying news of John's death, he finds instead a crowd numbering in the thousands, all looking for him. The next verse is almost gut-wrenching for me. It says, quote, "He had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd." He had compassion for them, for this huge crowd, in spite of his own grief, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Jesus sees that for all his devastating grief and sorrow, the whole flock of John's followers will be lost. Unless he does something, that whole mission will be lost. Unless he does something. For René Girard, the great French anthropologist whom I have long studied and often quote, this is a telling moment for Jesus. In his book, I See Satan Fall Like Lightning, Girard posits that this is the moment that Jesus learns about resurrection. It is the beginning of greatness in his ministry. He sees that if he takes up the mantle of John, his fate will be the same. It is unmistakable. He cannot avoid seeing that his prophetic calling will lead him to be killed, to be put to death in much the same way. And then perhaps one of his disciples may step up and be called the resurrection of Jesus. Would it be Peter or James or another John? He does not know, but he sees that this is inevitable. As he steps ashore to a crowd of thousands, he knows also that he has a choice. He could get back in the boat and get out of there. That choice would perhaps be most prudent. But his heart calls him, his very being pulls him, who he is. They are like sheep without a shepherd, a huge flock of lost sheep without him. In Girard's view, this is the turning point. Jesus decides to do it, feels compelled to step up, to feed his sheep. But he has this one additional insight, this one powerful insight. He decides to learn from John, to learn from John's death and from his resurrection, and to do it differently from John. He decides to be resurrected, not as Peter or James or a new John, but as himself, as Jesus. He sees that this and only this can have any hope ever of bringing to an end the endless slaughter of the prophets by the powerful. After this, the actions and the words of Jesus ascend to a whole new level. He feeds the 5,000 and the 4,000. He walks on water. He heals the blind. He unstops the tongue of the dumb. People loved it when he healed Jews. Now he sails deliberately across the lake into Gentile territory and begins a healing mission to non-Jews, to non-believers. He crosses the barrier from clean to unclean and brings that whole flock together, those two flocks together. And he begins carefully with great intention, to teach the 12 about what is coming, now that he is known. Fresh from all their amazing miracles, all these amazing miracles, when they are full of excitement about their amazing success and the notoriety that they are achieving with Jesus, he tells the disciples openly, teaches them, takes them apart and teaches them carefully and openly that he must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. End quote. It doesn't go well. Peter, perhaps catching the eye of a few others among the disciples, takes Jesus aside, as some of us might do, and tells him to just calm down, to just cut it out. Peter wants no more of this crazy talk. He rebukes Jesus, as the gospel tells us. And he wants no more of this talk, especially when everything has been going so incredibly well. Jesus' reply to Peter is legendary. "Get thee behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Then Jesus calls a general assembly of all the disciples and the whole crowd of thousands. "If any want to become my followers," he shouts, "let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life?" This is not a gospel that shrinks from threats, not a gospel of the fear of dying. This is a gospel of life for all eternally. Gerard's view of a Jesus who learns is somewhat at odds with our desire for a Jesus who is all-knowing and all-powerful from before his birth. But allowing ourselves to see Jesus this way has the great virtue of freeing us from the cognitive dissonance that so many people tell me they feel about Jesus. In this age of science and high technology, everywhere I go, people tell me, "Well, you know, I really miss church and I love it, but I just have this cognitive dissonance. Like, how does it work? How can I believe it?" And this Jesus, this learning Jesus, is a Jesus we can understand. Gerard's reading is highly consistent with the gospel account itself in great detail, and it places us in a framework of wholeness as human beings. It helps us see that the divine work of God through Jesus is done through gifts which Jesus has, which are relatable to our own. There's no doubt he has them to an absolute level that we do not, but his gifts are relatable to our own. God works through Jesus' intelligence, his insights, his reflection, his learning, his faithfulness, his loving heart, his courage, and his deep spirituality, just as God works through us in these very same and very holy ways. It makes it easier to see what is so very important for us to see, that here and now, today, we are part of the divine work of God still in all our faithfulness to Jesus.